Hi, and welcome back to episode 39. This is Occupy Frontier. This is the Occupy Interview Radio Show. And my guest, Charles Miller, an old friend of mine. Say hey, Charles, and introduce yourself, please.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me, Terry. I'm glad to be here. I think this is very exciting.
Looking forward to hearing what's the state of the frontier. You guys are about to kick off March Storm.
We're about to kick off the March Storm, which is fighting for a citizen space agenda. And you could actually maybe rephrase it a little bit, particularly for this audience, is kind of the Occupy the Space Frontier movement. It's very grassroots, fighting for a national space agenda that is for the people and not for special interests. And lots to talk about on that subject.
I'm really looking forward to hearing where we go with this. You guys are kind of unique. You get a really motivated group of citizen volunteer lobbyists. I was part of March Storm back 20 years ago or so, and I was really amazed how well it really seems to work, because the people on the Hill aren't always listening all that well, as we know at Occupy. Can you kind of talk about how you got started? You've got a really good record. A couple of your success stories would be really apropos at this point.
I would love to tell that. So the basic thesis here, and this is where it connects to the Occupy movement, is it's, I grew up with the dream that all of this would go to space someday, and that humanity as a whole, with America's lead, had a larger and greater purpose. That we would take life where there was no life, expand life from Earth into the cosmos, and that we would protect life here by going there. And there's this great dream. I grew up, I wanted to be part of this greater purpose, and it never happened. I just struggled with it, and it just came to me some one day that it was because of the big corporate interest. And also the big interests of big budget scientists, and as well as government bureaucracy, they didn't care about it. They used that dream for their own interest. But at the bottom, they really didn't care. That became second. And so it's really at its core, it's about the corruption of the system how our democracy gets abused by special big power interests and lots of people with lots of money. And back in the 90s, they said, well, you know, this is a free country. It's time to take responsibility. And I don't know about anybody here, but we were, from our generation, Terry, we were the children of Apollo, and we were promised we'd be in Mars by now, people going in reusable spaceships to permanent artificial gravity stations, and nothing's happened. It was all a lie. Or we were used. So I decided that since this is a democracy, I organized an activity to take private citizens to meet in D.C., and we would go advocate a citizen space agenda and go talk directly to members of Congress and their staff and advocate a citizen space agenda. And it was also designed very specifically. Very specific, measurable requests, like, we want you to do this, we want you to do that. And in the first year, it was very small. It was just 9 people at the beginning of the Internet who joined me. And we created a $25 million program with 1 week of activity. And in the next year, I said, well, that was like, if you round it up, it's $2.7 million, $3 million a person. I said, is 1 week of your life worth $3 million? And we were changing national space policy. And the fun little thing, everybody knows about Elon Musk and SpaceX and commercial spaceships, but we changed national policy and changed the law that made that happen. The March Storm grew, and it had a fundamental impact on national space policy. So that's what this is about. It's about taking back responsibility as private citizens for the future of our country and the future of this world.
The citizen advocates, the citizen lobbyists, and I was one, I think that was the year that we really were seeing the payoff with it, with SpaceX. That was a program we were trying to get some legislative attention.
Yeah, well, we passed a law that forced NASA and the U.S. government to buy cargo and to the space station from commercial companies. Otherwise, they would have just built another, you know, with the help of the big corporate companies that, like Uncle Sugar Daddy, they had this collusion. They would have had a big government program spending about 5 to 10 times what a SpaceX has cost to just send cargo to the space station. And it was completely unaffordable. It undercut democratic institutions. It was big government programs that made no economic sense. It was wasting taxpayers' money. And so he said it's time to do something different. And now SpaceX has a chance to be innovative, as well as many other companies. There's a revolution taking place.
The lobbyists, at least the year that I remember, basically was everything from college freshmen all the way up to some people that were retired from the old NASA. Are you still seeing that kind of spectrum?
We still see that, yes. There are people, great people work at NASA. I spent 3 years there about 5 years ago. And they hate it. They know that what we're doing doesn't make any sense, and they're stuck, and they see our nation stuck. And so we see in the March Storm across the spectrum. It's kind of a merger of the Tea Party and space and Occupy, and it's you have people on the far right and the far left and Greens and everybody. They all know that what we're currently doing doesn't work, and it's not getting what we want, and that we could do better. And nobody else is representing that, you know, idea, that, you know, choice to our members of Congress. Nobody brings that to them unless we do it. And so what we really did is we presented members of Congress with another choice. And the truth is most staff and most members of Congress go there with the intent to make a difference and doing the right thing, and this is what everybody needs to understand. They only can choose among the options that they're given. If you're sitting on the Hill and they only hear about option X and option Y, but those are both sucky options, but they never hear about the much better option Z because it's not any some big special interest to tell you about Z. They choose between X and Y, and that's what's going on in many areas in our national space policy. It's a battle of ideas in Congress, and the way you win is by introducing a new idea that's better and taking responsibility for introducing that new idea. And so that's what the March Storm does. And I think at the core, you know, right now we have, you know, basically every 6 months we send people to the International Space Station. And the International Space Station costs us $100 billion to create. It costs us $4 to $5 billion a year to keep going. But I didn't get into the space industry to do three people every 6 months, three Americans and our allies every 6 months. There's six people, but three of them are Russian. So our investment was $100 billion to get three people every 6 months. I'm not interested in people every 6 months or every 3 months or every month or every week. I want people per day. We need to be putting thousands of people into space, and we could do it. We have the technology today to build fully reusable space planes, like airplanes, that would transform our national space agenda. This technology has been around for at least 20 years, and it's what will fundamentally transform everything we're doing. And we'll have thousands of people going to space every year. It's huge benefits from such a system. You know, we could connect the other 3 billion people in the world who have no internet. We could create a broadband system in the sky that provided global internet anywhere on the planet. And that's affordable.
we'll have a link up that talks about that. That was last week, wasn't it, that they were talking about Google?
Yeah, well, and, yeah, they're talking about creating that based on SpaceX's system, but it's still going to be expensive broadband. It's going to be $100 per month type, or maybe $200 per month type broadband. You know, we could bring the affordability brought down much lower if we had cheap access to space with a reusable space plane. Another benefit of this Earth science, we currently do not monitor the entire Earth all the time everywhere. Carbon, we could create a global constellation of satellites in low Earth orbit affordably that monitor 24/7, 365 all the sources of carbon everywhere on the planet in real time. You want to do a monitoring system for the Earth's environment to monitor, track carbon and who the offenders and polluters are. We could afford to do that with a reusable space plane. Right now, we have one satellite in orbit called the Orbiting Carbon Observatory. That's over one spot at any time, and it never looks at, it's in sun synchronous orbit, so it's basically not, it never looks at spots in the middle of the night or the hottest part of the day. Well, what happens to the environment? The environment changes in the middle of the hottest part of the day or in the middle of the night. And so we have bad, you know, very limited science on the carbon, and we definitely couldn't monitor it. But with a space plane, we could transform Earth science. So it's just a system that could make huge differences here on Earth for everybody.
We're living about 12 minutes into the show now, and I wanted to go ahead and, if you could you give us a look at if anybody was interested in joining you on March Storm for this year, what are you going to be, what's the message to Congress this year?
Well, first of all, everybody, we have our agenda up online. You can go to marchstorm.com. That's one word, marchstorm.com. Our agenda's up there. There's basically 5 points. The first legislation, and we design this be very specific. We go into offices and say, will you support this bill, this language? Will you support this one? And usually members try to poo-poo you out and say how great you are, but if you ask them very specific questions, it forces them to actually do something to help rather than tell you how they share all your pain. That's useless. You know, it's useless to be told they share your pain. What are you doing about it? How do you measure and know they're doing something? So we have an agenda with like 5 things. So the first thing on the agenda is to amend the original act that states NASA's purpose, and to have that NASA's purpose includes the large-scale settlement of space, that humanity, not us, get to go, that's part of our purpose.
Okay, can you take about a minute or two, because that really will come as a surprise to most people. They would tend to think that's what the space program is.
Well, it's the space program is basically a jobs program, a very expensive jobs program for half a dozen to a dozen congressional districts and states. And it's really not, I think there's an emerging consensus among the middle level and most of the people in the space program that it should about getting humanity in space, but it's not designed to do that. So we're gonna make that official. It's not designed to, you know, open space to everybody. It's like I said, we spend $100 billion and we get 3 people to space every 6 months. It's not designed to produce a result that really makes a difference. And so we're gonna first amend the original organic NASA legislation to say that it is NASA's purpose to help incentivize and bring this new future for humanity about. And a lot of people in NASA want that to happen, but it's not official. So that's the first piece.
Okay.
The second piece is I talked about the reusable space planes and what a huge difference they would make, and that we have the technology today. But the issue is no one can close the business case. There's a bunch of companies who are working on it, from SpaceX is working on reusability, and Jeff Bezos has a company called Blue Origins that's working on reusability, and DARPA has a small program working on reusability. But that many of these companies could do it if they could close the business case. And so our legislation to do that is to create a multi-billion-dollar prize for the first two companies that can build fully reusable space planes. And that the largest prize is for proving you can fly the same space plane 10 times in 10 weeks. And that's where the really transformation comes. And that they, this is the key to the secret. We don't pay for it until they do it. And if they don't do it, it costs us nothing. It costs the taxpayers nothing if there's no result. We're not going to pay for effort, not going to pay for spending billions of dollars to try. You get paid when you do it. So it's a prize. And if you do it, then it changes everything. All the benefits I talked about before, plus it it will. We spend like $5 billion a year on space transportation today on these expensive launch vehicles. We will drop the cost of space transportation by an order of magnitude. So for the same things we're launching today for $5 billion, you know, think $500 million, an order of magnitude reduction in cost. You just basically save $4 billion a year. So a couple billion-dollar prize automatically pays itself. It is structured so it's win-win for everybody, for the taxpayer, for the American people, and for our future. And so that's we have a new way of doing that. So that's the second thing. We will also be supporting full funding for commercial crew and cargo. It's in the president's budget. The one area where he's been well ahead of his time. It started actually in the Bush administration, but President Obama doubled down on it, and the special interests hated the commercial crew and cargo program, but now it's creating revolutions in our space operations. And it's the source of SpaceX's really great innovation. This is the program that sparked the revolution caused by SpaceX. And then the fourth major item, and there's a few other minor items, but the fourth major item is we got this $100 billion space station up there, and it is our first foothold in space. In about 2024 or 2028, the U.S. government plans on throwing it away, which would just be after all that work to throw our foothold in space away, it would just be abysmal. And we've persuaded in the last year to the White House and NASA that there will be a transition to commercial space stations. So there's lots of work going on, and we don't need another gap in human spaceflight. So we're going to propose a strategy to have an early low risk transition to a commercial space station. There should be no gap. And we have a very specific concrete plan on how to do that, and we're going to advance that strategy in the U.S. Congress. And this creates the market for humans going to space, a place to go where it is the core of the first human settlement done right. This is where hundreds or thousands of people would travel to a space station. You just don't want to go up in space and sit in a tin can. You want to go up and get out and do a bunch of different things in space, and from sports to research to inventing new medicines and a whole bunch of other things. And you do that at a space station.
We're about 19 minutes into the show now. Also, you had the last component was your human space flight regulation control, I guess.
Right. Well, one of the things that we clearly advocate is accelerating the innovation of American entrepreneurs. And if you go back to the origin of flight, from the Wright brothers to Glenn Curtiss to Bill Boeing and Martin and all these other American entrepreneurs who created this industry, and they had a hugely rapid innovation. And one of the reasons they were able to innovate so fast is they didn't have a big bureaucratic government agency overlooking them. And they took informed risks, but they, this is where personal responsibility. They were some of them risked their lives and some people died, but they were allowed to do that. It was fundamentally American. You can go bungee jumping or climb the Himalayas or go row down a dangerous water rapids, and we consider that a fundamental right to, as long as you're not endangering someone else. If you want to take that risk, we ask that people be smart about it, and we encourage people to wear seat belts and helmets and that type of stuff. But we consider it part of freedom that if you want to risk, take a risk, that's allowed. And so the regulatory structure for building these suborbital commercial ROVs and orbital is you're allowed to risk your own life. You're just not allowed to risk somebody else's life. But there are parts of the government who don't like that. They don't like what happened with Virgin Galactic, where the pilot made a mistake, and they want to come in and start over-regulating the industry, which would slow down innovation and would destroy the business case of these companies. And it's kind of the culture of today. We would like to recreate, get the industry going and innovating, as long as they're not risking other people's lives. And then when they're flying other people, there'll be a different environment. But we just need to create a space for innovation for them right now. So we'll be advocating legislation to don't overregulate the industry.
We're 21 minutes into the show, and what I'd really, I don't know for sure that people really get a handle on what we're talking about doing is setting up these volunteers that'll be up there in March. We'll be helping set law.
I'll tell you, this is how we do it. So and the process is make it as easy as possible for the citizen who might be excited about this, but they say, well, how do you do this? So we make it, first of all, we set up all the meetings in advance based on who's registered. We want everybody to get on the website and register. Tell us where you're from. We need to know you have to be 18. We're not going to, we can't be responsible for children who are, or you have to bring your parent with you. But we give you all the training. We had a full day of training on the issue. We do practice sessions on briefing. You are on team. If you are new to this, you've never done it, it's a great experience. You will have people who've done this before who will be the leader of your team. And we set up the meetings. You go in with teams of three or four with a very specific agenda. And on the Sunday before the week, you show up for the Sunday full day training. We will train you on how to do this. We will practice it. You will practice it in team. And then we set up the team, and we set up all the briefing materials and packages. And you go as a team to 6, 7, 8 meetings a day that have been pre-set up for you. You figure out, different members of Congress have different issues they care about. Try to focus on those. Try to tie our agenda, our citizen space agenda, to why they would care. And then after the meeting, you make a report. You will get members who say, I will do X, and another one will say Y, and another one Z. And we need to document that because we are going to follow up with them and say, you said you'll do X. A lot of times they go, oh, you're right, and then they'll go track it down. And that's how we get legislation passed. That's how we get a change in national policy.
I haven't been through this. I've been around politics my whole life, but I've never been up on the Hill. And you start with pretty much the basics of, well, are you a registered voter? Because if you aren't, they're not interested. Can you kind of talk about, it seems like it's stuff that you wouldn't normally think about as an activist.
Right. Well, you start with, you start with the basics. So you go to a congressional office and you start with like, well, what do we know about this member of Congress? What do they say they're interested in? Why are they on? What committees are they on? And then we figure out which of the things we're pushing are relevant to the committees they're on. We tier our language. We go after both Republicans and Democrats, House members and senators. And you tier your message towards what you think will be more effective. And one of the things about space, and that it may be similar to other areas, so, you know, if you don't like the idea that we have these huge subsidies for oil, you don't go into Texas and tell them, you know, get rid of oil subsidies. If you don't like ethanol subsidies, you don't think ethanol is clean energy, and if you think it's a waste of money and there's much better, you know, clean energy sources, you don't go into Iowa and tell them get rid of, you know, ethanol subsidies. So we do the same thing in space. You don't go into certain districts and attack their special interests. In fact, this year we're going to be our agenda is designed to be totally positive. When they try to get us to talk about their interests, if it's not in our agenda, we don't talk about it. So, no, we're here to talk about this. And it's a very specific design tactic to change the conversation. We want to get them talking about a citizen space agenda, things that they can do, and not talk about the big corporate interests that they tend to focus on. And that can be, it's a very jujitsu type, you know, strategy in that way.
It also, a big part of it, again, is, you know, going into the office, what is going to be of benefit to that legislator, which, God forbid, yeah, the system actually works, but it is a representative form of government. So what is good for that representative theoretically should be good for his constituents.
Yeah, and you can find a tie. So that is a lot of the magic, is figuring out, you know, okay, this is what we know, why we care about this. And the truth is though, there's only 2-5% of the members of Congress who care about space. So we try to find a reason that really care about doing something in space, because it's kind of esoteric. So we try to find a reason, why do they care about it? Is there a district interest? Are they on a specific subcommittee where this is an issue? And help, you know, would this create economic jobs? So one of the benefits of a reusable space plane, right now we have a $250 billion a year commercial space industry. If we have cheap access to space, that's going to, just the growth rate is going to literally rocket. And it'll grow into a $1 trillion a year industry. So that creates jobs for Americans. That's economic growth. That works for the members of both aisles. Another benefit is it will benefit national security. Right now, you know, and so you look, if somebody's on armed services, or they got something on their website to indicate that they care a lot about national security, you talk about, for the space planes, the big problem today in space, one of the big problems is we're subject to a Pearl Harbor style attack in space. We have these multi-billion-dollar spacecraft up in orbit, and there's a couple dozen of them, and we got GPS, and China if we got in a war with China, they could take them out. And they've actually proven recently they have the technology to take out our satellites, that they could take them out quite rapidly, and we would be dumb, deaf, and blind. All our systems, you know, all these smart bombs, they depend on GPS. Our ability to fight a war depends on our ability to use our geosynchronous satellites. These UAVs that we're using to take out ISIS today, they're communicated and controlled by satellites in geosynchronous orbit. And China could take that out, or another bad actor. I think China is unlikely to do it, but a crazy North Korea, there's ways they could use to take it out, or Iran. And it could have devastating consequences. But with a reusable space plane, we could pop up satellites in days or a couple weeks and replace them all, and do so cheaply. And if they did it again, we could replace them again. So and what this does is not so much that fighting the war, it takes the incentive out to start the war. And it's from my perspective, it's a stabilizing deterrent to war. It's against war from happening. If somebody's tempted because you have a weak spot to attack you, that could start the war. And so if we just eliminate that weak spot and say, okay, they have these reusable space planes, that would just start a war that we're going to lose. That's just a dumb idea. It keeps the peace. So So that would be the issue that you talk about to somebody on armed services or who had a military base in their district or who used to serve in our military and defend our country. And many members, even if they're not on those things, care about national security and protecting the nation. And this is most of the benefits of a reusable space plane are commercial and civil and benefits to environmental science and transforming global connections of the world, but if you also can tie it to national security, that might be it to justify our legislation.
With the emphasis on Department of Defense and not offense, basically everything you were talking about would be a defensive use as opposed to, I think there's a lot of people who are vehemently opposed to huge budgets for offensive use.
Right. This would it would lower the cost. We spend an awful lot on defense, Department of Defense on space systems that we don't need to spend. So having a reusable space plane would radically lower the cost, and it prevents the war. It's not about starting the war. It's the best way to fight a war is never having to fight a war.
Since you would agree, we're half an hour into the program, and basically that's kind of why we wanted to bring you on. We had James Bura in a couple of months ago with Space Frontier Foundation, and he was giving us a quick overview of what was going on then. Now you're giving us the legislative outlook here. What's key for the Occupy movement is it's an anti-austerity. That is what the world opposition is, that people have to get by with less so that a few can get more. If you don't want to have income redistribution, we had Dr. Walter Block on, who was talking about growth. Economics, growth in economics isn't even considered anymore. We had to search the world over to find an economist who could even begin to talk
about
it.
Well, I think that the world that I'm talking about is the world of abundance.
Worlds. We're the space people. Let's start with worlds. As of 1969, ESA considers the Earth Moon system to be a binary planet. That's the other half of this world. Pretty much shoots anything that's Malthusian, which was what Dr. Bach was saying. Malthusian economics, controlled growth has to be obsolete. So let's talk about growth, because really we're the only ones that are talking about it. And if you could talk about that on the Hill right now, are you seeing people's reluctance to even consider the concept of growth?
I think a lot of people would like it, but you would have to give them a plan that would create growth. And we're such a cynical, skeptical world today, and we don't want to get suckered. So when you bring up a plan for growth and abundance, you also have to tell them what they can do that makes sense. And the Citizen Space Agenda will create a world of abundance. It's a revolutionizing space transportation with space planes, which we have the technology to do today, will transform all kinds of areas of human civilization. And the truth is, it will expand human civilization throughout the solar system. So the resources of the solar system become available to humanity. And imagine that you're trying to clean up a lake or a pond, but you're living inside the pond. That it makes it really hard, but if you can get out of the pond and have an open system rather than a closed system, it transforms the solutions that can be available. So there is huge amounts of resources in the solar system, from clean, abundant energy from the sun. You want to talk about solar energy, think about space solar power. We have, and then the resources of the solar system and the asteroids and the planets are hugely abundant. And humanity that's spreading throughout the solar system, that's a united, free, peaceful humanity, is just eminently possible. And part of how you do that is changing people's perspective. If we could take the leader of every country on this planet, or that the top 50 leaders of the, every country in this planet, and have them see the Earth from space and see the Earth as this fragile, blue marble that there, you can't see any boundaries from space, that we are all in this together, and we need to protect this planet, and that it's much larger than ourselves. I think it would transform our politics. So there's a lot at stake here.
About 35 minutes into the show, and I really, if we can, it would be nice to kind of punch up on that particular point. Right now, that same year that we went to the moon, 69, there are now twice as many people as there were on the planet in 1969, but we're not really using all those resources. And what is it about the current system of our frontier isn't working very well? I'm not getting much lunar benefit that I can see. How do we improve that with this legislative program you're pushing?
Well, it's about it's having a different perspective, and then having a clear, specific plan to pull it into existence. Now, one of the things that that I think the American public and much of the world, I think that much of the world got it in their gut, which is why it was probably, as a percentage of the world who watched it, is probably, considering the technology today, and the whole world saw it, that the first humans stepped on the moon in July of 1969, is that we really realized it was a big deal for all of humanity, and we were all in this together. And we expected more to happen, but the truth is that the real reason for Apollo had nothing to do with humanity's expansion into space. That was not an urgent priority. And if you go back to the tapes in the Kennedy administration, they actually have their recorded tapes that have the NASA administrator with Kennedy saying that was nice, but the real reason for Apollo was soft power. It was that, you know, we had been threatened by the Soviet Union. Khrushchev had pounded his shoe on the table in UN and basically said they were going to bury us. And we didn't believe it until Sputnik, they put up the first satellites, and then Gagarin, they put up the first human. It was actually less in the United States, but the rest of the world, all these hundreds of other countries around the world, more than 100, said, well, maybe freedom and democracy is not the way to go. These Russians seem to be beating Americans and innovation in the future. Maybe we should seriously consider totalitarian, socialistic, communist practices. And so it was really about proving that the American way of life, freedom and democracy, to the rest of the world was the right way. We had to choose a challenge that we could beat the Russians at, the communists. And Kennedy explicitly picked something that we could do, that we could do first, and it would beat the communist Soviet Union. And that was the fundamental purpose. He did not care about all the other benefits. He thought they were nice, and he had some great speeches. But it's in the tapes. He didn't care about all the other things that would go along that would sustain this about humanity expanding into space. And it did a great job. And so after, it's actually you can track it also the American people in the Congress. They almost immediately lost interest after the first couple of Apollos. The rockets had been built, so they let them do a few others. They actually had a couple rockets, Apollo rockets, and the systems ready to go, but they actually intentionally shut them down before they could go because they were worried that, someone would die. And it wasn't affordable. It was a throwaway, big Manhattan-style project-style approach to prove we could get there fast. It wasn't designed to be affordable or sustainable in the long term. And it was a different path that only had one goal, which it achieved. And so this dream that people were thinking where the government was going to open up its coffers and just pour huge amounts of taxpayers' money into this was a false illusion, and because that was not the real purpose. But we can achieve that dream, but in a much different strategy that's much more cost-effective, that has all these dual-use and tri-use benefits that pays for itself. And that's the new strategy, that it needs to be a partnership with private industry, and going to space, somebody has to pay. And so we are going to leverage this by leveraging not only commercial innovation, but commercial markets that people care about, clean energy, materials, medicine, communications, all of which can be transformational around the world. And that's how we open space to all the people.
We've got about 20 minutes left in the show. In addition to the cost, the human cost of space flight, trying to keep the funding plateaus at a point during the Vietnam War, just couldn't do guns and butter. What we'll have links up to Space Frontier Foundation's Better Way. What's the video that you guys have? There's a Better Way.
There's a Better Way. Yes.
Yeah, that's basically gives you a more detailed look at part of the legislative package, the settlement approach that you're taking. And can you real briefly? We'll have both the video link, and we'll have the link to the details of the step-by-step-by-step incremental approach, as opposed to one Hail Mary throw out to tomorrow.
Hail Mary, giant.
I choked trying to say that. It's like they've already fooled us once. I really hate to get fooled on this again. And Occupy people aren't going to go for this. That's they've seen and heard some.
Well, they are right to be skeptical.
Yes,
fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Right? So,
amen. But that's not the program you guys are advocating, and I want to make that very clear.
We are actually talking about taking the existing. You know, back in Apollo, we spent 4% of the GDP on Apollo. We spent a huge amount of our national treasure and taxes on this because it was a national security imperative, not because of any other reason. And there really was a existential threat from communism that everybody felt at the time, and we needed to prove that the American way of life was better. And Apollo did that in front of the entire world. So it succeeded, but that's what it was. It wasn't about people going to space. Right now, we basically have a stable pattern over the last 30, 40 years right now we're spending half of 1%, and you're amazed at how little it is. It's half of 1% of the federal budget goes to NASA. That's one two-hundredth of the federal budget goes to NASA. Well, we're not asking for more money. We're basically saying with that budget that's been pretty stable, it goes up and down a little bit over the year by year, but it's not a huge difference. We can get much more bang for the buck. You know, we can spend it much better and actually make a much better difference for the people. And it's right now, much of that money goes into, you know, creating, you know, white-collar welfare jobs in many cases. They recently came out in the Washington Post. They spent $300 or $400 million on a rocket test stand in Mississippi that they never used. And they knew they weren't going to use, but they spent it anyway because powerful congressional interests in Mississippi. It's just ludicrous the amount of taxpayer money we waste on sometimes because some powerful member of Congress says, no, I want $300 million spent in my district. And the people working on it were just aghast. They thought they were doing a good thing for the American people by building this rocket test stand. And the moment they finished it, they mothballed it. It's just a shame. And so our agenda is to take the existing budget we do spend and spend it much better. Get do something that makes a difference for not just for the people who have the jobs. There'll be the same number of jobs, but have it actually produce a result that makes a difference in the world. And so that's what we're really about. And that's what you can go on markstrom.com and find out more information. And you can register there right now. And for those in the Occupy movement, this is a great, if you like space, but this is, you know, it's also a great opportunity to learn how to do that. You know, we
yes.
would love to have some members of who like science and space, but really want to learn how to do this. We'll teach you how to do it.
Yes, I can't begin to. Yes, they really will teach you how to do it. It's amazing how much you'll learn and how quickly. And you, some of your guys have been up there on the hill for their entire careers. Is James Muncy still on the hill?
Yeah, Jim Muncy. Well, he's one of the founders of Space Frontier Foundation. So we have. There are people who share this vision, who know that our national space agenda has not been designed to produce results, who are part of our network, who are trying to fix it, trying to transform it. And so Jim Muncy is one. One of our college students from the second March storm, who showed up the second March storm. He came from Embry-Riddle, now works on Capitol Hill in for a senior member of Congress in a space policy position. He's a great position to make a difference. And so we have people throughout connections throughout the national space policy agenda about working. And so you get involved, it could be part of your career. We have people who learned how to do lobbying on this, and they now do it in totally different industries, but they learned it from us.
Yes, you guys did an excellent job very quickly of showing what's involved with trying to do effective legislative action. And on top of that, basically the philosophical point from the millennial age bracket, there's not much future that they can see. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, grow or die. We've kind of explored the controlled growth, which is another way of saying death. Wide open growth on the program you're talking about. It starts with basically where we're at with Mr. Musk. He tried to recover a booster last week. Had an almost a famous aerospace. Well, it was almost a success. But had he managed to do that, it would have cut the cost, according to him, in half. That would have been one more.
That's part of the benefits of bringing in commercial innovation. Mr. Musk has figured out a way. He launches a paying customer to space, and for very little additional cost, he's innovating how to actually recover the booster. So he's trying to land it on a barge, and it was a brilliant way to how to recover this system. So he gets part way to a reusable launch vehicle. In fact, about 80 to 90% of the cost is in that first booster, and it's the easiest part to recover. And that's part of we passed this law in 1998 called the Commercial Space Act of 1998 to require NASA to buy commercial space station cargo delivery services, and we got these innovators into this industry. We created this pathway for them, and they are accelerating innovation in so many different ways so fast. It's having a huge impact, but that's part of the benefit of the citizen space agenda. We knew this was going to happen, and it's actually now happening.
And to tie it back in, you have to have the human spaceflight regulations, the current legislative package. So basically you have an ongoing program here. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show, and I guess that's what I'm really looking for here is it's so hard to not give up. It is so hard to even feel like, you know, this really sucks. We got about 10 minutes here about what, tell us about an alternate future. Tell us about a society that chooses to grow again. that's what you guys are trying to create out there.
Absolutely. So it comes down to a fundamental choice. Every person, you know, needs to sit down and decide, are you going to give up, or are you going to, you know, why are you here? Are you here for some greater purpose? And there is no guarantee, but were you here for a greater purpose to go make a difference? And if you want to dedicate yourself to a larger cause, larger than yourself, you can't be stopped. You know, you're here, focus on the possibility that you could make a difference and then dedicate yourself to that greater purpose. It's not about you. Then you can make a difference. This type of activity is for whatever issue you care about, could make a difference. The only thing that has changed the world is small numbers of people. That every great revolution, like the American Revolution for Freedom, starts with a small level of people, and it starts with people who said, this is what, took a stand and invited other people to join them in that making a difference. And I'm absolutely convinced that humanity is on the verge of a hugely abundant future, that the resources of the cosmos are available to us, and that we can solve the problems that are taking place here on Earth, the environmental problems. We can create new jobs, and part of that is changing how we think of things. This is not about big government or big business or, you know, all government all the time or all business all the time. That's a false debate. The real change, the benefits where the changes are made, is figuring out how you can marry the best of government with the best of commercial business, particularly entrepreneurial innovation. And how can you encourage that accelerated growth and innovation? And that's the most exciting thing about America. We have all kinds of things, that entrepreneurial growth going on with young, very bright entrepreneurs making a difference. Now, most of them are doing it in apps or blogs, but we can do the same thing in real hardware, and Elon Musk is proving it. There is huge opportunities opening up for people who would like to start a space business. All this change is really threatening to the big traditional guys. They don't understand it. They're really struggling with it. And it's a threat to them, but it's an opportunity to everybody else who wants to make a difference and have growth and build a business. And, the solar system is filled with resources. The amount of energy that has got transformed through the Earth-Moon system, clean, abundant solar energy, is far beyond what the Earth uses right now. So I'm convinced, if with the proper strategy, we can do all of this.
Got about 7 minutes left. Amplifying, there's a perception that the problem with Fukushima is absolutely insolvable, that there's no way that technology could ever get that mess back under control. But if you're actually looking at the data that's coming in from Fukushima, we have to address the problem of Fukushima. One of the nice things about aviation people is we tend to rise to the challenge of it'll never fly. Have you got any feelings about problems like insolvable problems like Fukushima?
Well, it's hubris. You know, there's always lots of problems. One book I really like is The Black Swan. Again and again and again, we have blinders on about specific issues, and it's just the nature of humanity that what we don't know what we don't know, Nicholas Taleb talks about it. He calls it the turkey problem. Think of you're the turkey. You're fed every day. Your life is sweet, very easy. You're getting fat and having a great life, and all of your friends, the other turkeys around you. But you don't, on the 500th day, you don't know what's going to happen. And you just don't know what you don't know. So there's some of the greatest fractures in human history were things that most people didn't recognize and ignore and forget. And people forget that they forget. And I think we will conquer these things. A lot of times it's just short-term problems. It may be very difficult for people who are losing lots of their jobs. And the Occupy movement is quite right that usually the big money interests take care of themselves first, and the vast majority of people are forgotten. But eventually we overcome, but part of that is by we're never gonna, you know, the reason to get skeptical is by not taking personal responsibility. Being skeptical and giving up is giving up responsibility for making a difference for you and for everybody else.
Well, the big money then and now, the difference was that the big money was involved with the transportation system of the Western frontier. The Rothschilds did very well off of imperialism,
right,
and colonizing Africa and America's,
right,
West. And so if they choose to adopt a policy of growth, then that they can make a fortune there, too. They don't have to do it this way. What are we doing to try to help influence those guys to make the good choice of, hey, guys, growth. Hello, growth.
It's all about aligning incentives and making sure, you know, preventing fraud. So I think we have the best system in the world, and it's got its flaws, for improving transparency, and one of the best justice systems. But even though it's in this world where with the internet, we are becoming more and more aware every day of the limits of how good it is. Right. So, but think about how it was 100 or 200 years ago when there was no internet. And you only could believe what was in the local newspaper, which was kind of one or two pages. That was, and if they controlled, if somebody owned that, whoever owned that one newspaper you're dependent on and didn't tell you the whole story, there was the amount of abuses was, I think, orders of magnitude higher. So I am actually quite hopeful that the revolution of the internet and open society we're finding more and more of this bad stuff going on, but it is actually the act of finding is taking away is the biggest disincentive for doing it in the future. That people are adjusting, like, well, you know, cops, what cops have been caught in the act doing. That's going to transform community policing. And that's always taken place. We just didn't know. We didn't have the proof we have today. So I'm actually hopeful that things are getting better very fast, and we are going to and much more resources are coming to bear than anybody really recognized. And in the short term, it looks bad, but in the long term, the trends are very good. But part of that is we need to jump in as private citizens and not be couch potatoes and take responsibility. If you want to make a difference and you want to have someone teach you how to make a difference, and we will do that for you. Come to the March Storm. Go to marchstorm.com and sign up now, and we will help you how to take back your government.
That's the last minute of the show, and I can't really think of a better way to have ended it out. Hopefully we'll be able to get you back in again and some of the other people to try to describe what are the opportunities for growth. Let's start exploring growth as a policy option. And you guys seem to be out in front on that, and hopefully you're going to teach a whole bunch more of our Occupy people how to be more effective doing that. It's been a pleasure, as always, Chad. We'll have links up, and look forward to talking to you again soon. Any last thoughts? About 30 seconds.
Thanks for having me, Terry. I really appreciate it. And let's occupy the space frontier.
Sounds good to me. It sure beats the alternative. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.